Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon. This is Nathaniel Coburn again for Heritage Radio Network Community Sessions. Today I'm on the line with Chef Peter Hoffman, chef and owner of Back 40 and Back 40 West, and the now defunct Savoy in Soho. Chef Hoffman is a longtime board member and former president of the Chefs Collaborative Board, which is the leading nonprofit network of chefs working to change the sustainable food landscape using the power of connections, education, and responsible buying decisions. He organized and produced the collaborative's Seafood Solutions Guide to Sustainable Fish Procurement and presented the material around the nation as part of the collaborative's ongoing commitment to educating chefs and consumers about fish issues. Check out his restaurant group online at www.back40nyc.com. Good afternoon, Chef. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad to be here.
So you've been focused on local sourcing, as the hipsters would like to say, long before it was cool. What spurred that? What were you seeing that made you start to do this practice before a lot of other folks caught on?
Well, I think it really was as a chef, the farmers markets was such a point of inspiration for me to walk through and see what was pristine and at peak ripeness and of course, you know, things like short transportation time was something that was already embedded in the very nature of a farmer selling directly his own produce to the in the marketplace, so that was very exciting for me and inspirational as a chef. So it just sort of started from there. It wasn't necessarily you know, about politics or, you know, as people have said, the idea of locavore didn't really exist, or that as a unifying concept. It was just like, wow, this is great stuff. Let's take it back to the kitchen. And so, on a certain level, it still remains that.
Mm-hmm. So when you first started out, I mean, were you always cooking like this, or was it one day you were ordering from Sysco and US Foods, and the next day you were like, I want to buy some kale from that farmer over there? Like, how did you start to introduce it under the menu?
Right. Well, I was working at a restaurant that was on 22nd Street and Park Avenue. It was called Hubert's at the time, in the early 80s, and that was we were part of what was at that time called New American Cuisine. Mm-hmm. And that was really the beginning of the new set of direct relationships between chefs and producers, in which a lot of folks around the country started to say, I don't need to go chase what's in Europe and import Dover sole and things like that. There's all this wonderful product that's right here. So again, you know, as the journey continues to be, there's always a mix of what's in your walk-in and on your menu, and you're always looking for new sourcing and figuring out how do you balance pricing and readily available and all these superior, wonderful ingredients as well.
Sure. And as it started out, what did awareness around this issue look like when you first began doing it, and how has it grown over the years from your experience?
I missed the one key word. What did what look like?
I just forgot my own question. Awareness, I think, was
awareness,
what I was asking
about. Awareness, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was the word.
That is a key word.
Well, again, I mean, you know, depends on sort of which slices that you want to look at it from. Mm-hmm. It's like what we were doing was there weren't very many chefs shopping in the green market. There were certainly diners who appreciated and noticed the difference, and again, it was sort of, all of this was the beginning of, you know, starting to try and tell the story on your menu that items came from a certain farmer who was local and things like that. Of course, that went overboard, and every line was, you know, day boat Chatham scallops with Guy's asparagus and upstate vinegar kind of thing, and that people started to make fun of, and I understood that. I mean, I think there's a way that you can tell too much of a story, and then people glaze over, and they don't want to hear about it. So,
your choices become a limitation instead of a expanded horizon.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was part of the awareness arc, you know, if you will, in terms of people going like, well, really, it matters where things come from. Let's start telling the story. And then people go like, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter. I've heard that story 1,000 times. And now sort of we have embedded in just the culture of the restaurant for the cooks, for the diners as well, that this is how we purchase, and it's part of what this restaurant is all about and what it's become known for.
Mm-hmm. You've spoken elsewhere about your belief in cooking from one cultural palate at a time. I believe it was in a Diner's Journal in the New York Times you spoke about that. And I'm curious as to why and what that says about your views on cuisine as a culture, a representative of culture, and what a chef's responsibility is to that.
It's a really interesting question.
Because there's a lot of fusion, right?
And there's a lot of fusion. There's a lot of mashups being done today, and I don't want to say that they're wrong, because I think that for certain people, for certain chefs, that may be kind of who they are and what it is.
It's a culture of its own.
But I think it easily gets muddied and confusing, and you don't know what you're eating, and you don't know what the flavor profiles or the flavor, what the picture is that you're trying to paint. And a guiding force, you know, a time-honored guiding force are sort of sets of flavor profiles and relationships that have been worked out by different cultures, you know. So I like those, and I find it a little sort of, mind-bending, kind of jarring to jump around on the menu from Japan to Mexico to Morocco. So I don't like that in particular. If somebody has a vision and they're going to say, I'm using, some of these Mediterranean spices, but it's got, some Oriental push on it in terms of like what the, how the vegetables were prepared or some other aspect of it. I probably can get behind that if there's a overall integrated view on the part of the chef. But the kind of like, let's jump around the world over the course of the menu and the course of the evening, I find just not appetizing.
No, there's subtle ways and not so subtle ways, right? Like there's a Tex wasabi way, and there's a something that's not maybe quite as glaring and in your face and horrible.
Yeah.
This guide you put together for Chefs Collaborative on sustainable fisheries and procurement guidelines for chefs, there's a lot going on with sustainable fish right now, and there's a lot of damning reports about mislabeling. There's a new fish that's going on the list of do not eat. It seems like every other week or so. In the guide, you stress the importance of relying on trustworthy purveyors, and that the purveyor relationship is crucial to ensuring quality of product and all of that. Given what's going on in the industry right now, how do you ensure that your purveyor is also knowledgeable and informed as well?
And honest.
Yes, and honest.
Well, let's see. There's a couple of things just to try and dive into that. The first is that, and one of the things that we talk about in the guide and has always been a principle is like, I'm not just a locavore. I mean, I know that that's sort of how I got pegged and framed, but that's not the only thing that me, and so it's sort of in different ways we can look at what the overall impact is that we're having. And so local, in the case of seafood, that may or may not make sense. That may or may not be the best choice. And a lot of times, at this point, local seafood or non-local seafood may be a great choice, so that if we're going to get involved in flying some of our food around the world, I'll take a piece of beautiful Norwegian cod that's sustainably managed by the Norwegians, then I'll be interested in industrial asparagus from Peru in the middle of August. So, you know, it's just like, we don't need to, I'm going to say, I don't need to have a cuisine in New York where I'm serving asparagus in the summer or the fall, but I am going to sort of, if you give me an allowance for you know, fossil fuel energy travel miles, I'll expend it on some great fish that's coming in from, say, from Norway or from Alaska, places like that.
Absolutely. Well, I understand you had an opportunity last year to join the Norwegian Seafood Council on a fairly, it seems like, a unique trip to Norway to see firsthand some of the sustainable fishing practices up there. What did you see?
Well, that trip was primarily focused on salmon, aquaculture, which, you know, there are sort of worldwide, there are a lot of problems with and you know, sort of issues around them, all kinds of things in terms of what the fish are fed and where that feed is coming from, in terms of taking wild fish out of the ocean and depriving other wild species of it, and waste issues in terms of how close together the fish are penned, and then what kind of, whether they're treated with antibiotics and other medicines, and spreading that around. And so, in general, salmon aquaculture worldwide has a lot of problems with it. And so, I didn't come to it as a fan or a proponent of it.
You were skeptical.
Very. Mm-hmm. And I would say I, in terms of that, I retain some of that skepticism. Although I think that. I think that what I saw there in Norway is that the government is trying to find the balance between promoting the industry because it's good for their business and good for their economy, and doing it in a way that's safe and sustainable and long and has longevity. You know, like they're not going to invest in that if the whole thing is going to collapse in 5 or 10 years.
Right,
that said, you know, there we've, you know, back to sort of how you open is like we've fished out a lot of the world, and it's really kind of tragic what we've done, and so we may depend on aquaculture a lot, and in the future if we want to eat seafood, but you know, on a certain level it doesn't look a whole lot different than other kinds of industrial farming.
Now what does ocean farming look like, what's it, because that's what they do up there with the salmon, right, in Norway? That's ocean farm salmon. Am I correct? What is this an alternative to?
Well, I mean, that's it's an interesting question to say what's an alternative to. I don't think it's an alternative to wild salmon.
Okay.
You know, and at times, if it's perceived in the marketplace as an alternative to wild salmon, the problem with that is that it makes it harder for wild salmon, and the price, the costs that are involved in getting that fish out of Alaska or out of the Pacific Northwest into New York becomes non-competitive if people think it's the same thing just because it's salmon. So it's not the same thing, doesn't taste the same, and it doesn't have the same story behind it. Mm-hmm. So is it, you know, is it a useful and delicious form of marine protein? Sure. It certainly is that and can be that, but it doesn't replace what the wild fish is. The wild fish is really something very special and needs to be honored for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, so, you talk in the guide about incorporating a hybrid model of using a small portion of like a wild-caught fish in tandem with a farm-raised product. I think you used the example of halibut paired with farm scallops.
Right.
I'm interested about that in terms of like how, when you talked earlier about creating dishes around these types of proteins, what does it differ depending on whether you use farm-raised or wild-caught? How does that inform what the dishes you create?
Yeah, sure. One of the things is that the wild fish become, as we overfish them, things that we used to consider to be just ubiquitous, like cod. I mean, in this country, in the Northeast, when I was a kid, what was for dinner? Fish. We're having fish for dinner, and fish was cod. Mm-hmm. It didn't even have a name. It was just fish. And now it's gotten to the point where cod on menus in New York is a specialty item. So that's the result of us as a nation, as a globe, squandering the resource and just catching every last damn fish so that there was little left, and we had to close the George's Banks. And it devastated the fishing fleets of New England.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we continue to, support some of those fishermen and still eat that fish is you have to cherish it and charge more for it, whether it's I'm charged more for it by my purveyor or I charge the customer more for it. And so the way you go, well, I'm not the kind of restaurant where you're going for dinner and you're going to be served, a one ounce slice portion, and you're paying $16 for the food because you're just so glad to be in those surroundings. I feel like you have to build the dish with other things, and so the idea of taking sustainably raised, mollusks, whether it's those scallops that are mentioned in there, or clams, and other things that are readily repopulating, is a great way to sort of build the seafood dish and still give you something really special.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you using Norwegian skrei in your restaurants?
Yeah. So the story about the skrei is a great story of both sustainability and availability of wild fish.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's migratory. The term skrei is the Norwegian term for it, and it means that it's migratory cod as opposed to cods that sort of are more familiar to us, which are non-migratory. So it's a seasonal product.
They just had their spawning season, didn't they?
Yeah.
January through April.
So they spawn up in the Barents Sea, which is, the way, way north of northern Norway and into Russian waters. And it was overfished in the past, and the Norwegians and the Russians got together and decided to come up with a management plan, and they put it in place, and it's actually been very effective. So they're currently, and hopefully, fingers crossed, they won't blow it, but there's lots of fish.
Mm-hmm.
So, I love cod. The Norwegians have completely figured out how to move this fish from the fishing boat to the processor and then to the airport and to us, here in New York, in the shortest amount of time with the highest quality, temperature never lost, and always impeccable. Mm-hmm. So the fish that many of us chefs in New York had the opportunity to work with in mostly March of this year was just incredible fish, you know, mind-blowing, and to think that it, from where it came from, and still very affordable. So I'm really excited about that being in the marketplace and a story that we can tell our diners, you know, a good story that's both about seasonality, that this that our food isn't here all the time, and it comes and it goes in and out of season, and that's something to celebrate as a something as opposed to something to be pissed off about, you know, and that we're not, it's not a high value to have ubiquitousness. You know, that for me often equates with just industrial production and not necessarily a product that we're excited to serve. So
and a lack of reverence for what you're consuming, I think, you know.
Yeah, right. It's as good as, you know, anything that came out of a manufacturing plant, you know, a box of nails. And our food and the pleasure that we take from it isn't about an industrialized product. So I'm really looking forward to having that on our menus and more widely available and seen and understood next January through April.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, as we're seeing alternative kinds of fish or different kinds of species on fish, and I'm still actually not clear. Skrei is cod; it's not a different kind of cod.
That's right. It's just a distinct population that doesn't interbreed with the non-migratory cods that are in other parts of the Atlantic.
So when you're telling this story to consumers, are we still calling it cod on the menu?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, the folks at the Norwegian Seafood Council want to have it called Skrei. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that that's a term that's going to have legs here in the United States or here in New York.
Yeah, I was curious.
And I think that I proposed to them that they call it migratory cod or Norwegian migratory cod, something like that, that in telling it, and that's something, it's English, and so you put it on the menu, and then that might prompt a question of the waiter to say, migratory cod? What's that? Or whatever, some people just glaze over and they read the word cod, and that's enough. But,
sure.
You know, that it begins to suggest the question of, like, oh, migratory? I mean, not all fish lives there year-round, or there's fish that does migrate? What's that whole deal? So, so we'll see where that goes. I think it's a great opportunity to tell people the story, but you have to figure out how to do that.
Yeah, I've been really interested in this sort of what the dividing line is between responding to a demand versus trying to create one, and how you market a different species under those conditions. You know, like the use of bycatch with more and more frequency, the same sort of thing. You know, like we're trying to move away from these no fishes. You know, like bluefin. Like everybody knows bluefin is bad now, and or hopefully, and there's a whole bunch of others, I'm sure. You know, like how do you what goes into trying to change consumer tastes to reflect something that is sustainable and that is good and that is an alternative? That seems like an interesting process to me.
Yeah, it's a tricky dance. Mm-hmm. All of that. I mean, it's just like, you know, part of it starts with, you know, some people will say, I know that's not a great fish to be selling, but my customers want it, and so therefore it's still on my menu, or I'm still as a supplier selling it, because if I don't sell it, the other guy's going to sell it. You know, I feel that there are times that we have to take stands as human beings, and in this case, human beings who are the owners of businesses or the chefs of businesses that make buying decisions, and lead the way. Mm-hmm. we still have to cook food that people want to eat. And, you know, bluefin tuna isn't the only thing that, that people want to eat. And we have a responsibility to, you know, say I'm not going to participate in the destruction of the planet if I can step aside from that and at the same time still find things that, that people are excited about and delicious. I mean, you can't run a menu in a restaurant just selling mackerel and sardines and herring, you know, because they're plentiful and they're healthy and oily and all of that. I mean, people like white-fleshed fishes. I mean, you know, we grew up on it. What's for dinner? Fish. And that meant cod. So, you know, in a certain way, this the idea that the scray or the migratory cod is available and well-managed and also flown in, you know, is a very interesting choice and fish that's available to us now some of the year to share with our customers. So,
yeah, it's great news for everybody.
Yeah.
Chef, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here. Thanks for asking all the good questions.
This has been Nathaniel Coburn for Heritage Radio Community Sessions. We've been speaking with Chef Peter Hoffman of Back 40 and Back 40 West. I want to thank you for tuning in to Heritage Radio Community Sessions. This broadcast, in addition to the over 30 weekly shows produced by Heritage Radio Network, is available for free on our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.